If someone asked for proof that Jesus is alive, how would you respond? Welcome to Good Word, a program dedicated to exploring issues of faith and the Bible. Our discussion focuses today on the Gospel of Luke, and our specific title is Crucified and Risen. So we're talking about the very end of Jesus' life here on earth. My name is Paul Dibdahl. With me, I have Brant Berglund, a colleague in the School of Theology at Walla Walla University, and Pam Kress, a professor in the School of Social Work and Sociology also at Walla Walla University. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
So could you produce proof that Jesus is alive? And I ask the question again, and just as you're about to answer, I want to hold that question. Probably the last question we'll okay. talk about right at the end. First, the events leading up to the crucifixion. Us people have noted that the Bible in some ways begins, not in some ways, it does begin in a garden, the Garden of Eden. And then we have this event in the life of Jesus, leading right up to the crucifixion, the Garden of Gethsemane figures prominently. And then finally, when the kingdom is ultimately restored, we again enter a kind of garden paradise or heaven. What might we learn as we compare the events that took place in the Garden of Eden with what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane? Are there similarities, differences? How are these two garden stories connected?
Yeah. Well, I think they're connected in one way, in that sin entered in one garden, and sin, the beginnings of sin's conquering, were in the other garden. And that was the first thing that came to mind when I looked at that question. Mm-hmm. So Eden, we have the beginnings of sin, and Gethsemane, we have the beginnings of sin being conquered.
Wonderful.
After that, no, nothing. No, that's a great way to look at it. And if I can build on that just a little bit, Pam, I would say that in the first garden is where you had perfection come to an end, which is amazing to think about. Adam and Eve, they're perfect, and here you have Jesus now, 6,000 years of human sin or plus, mm-hmm. you know, who knows how many years, but, you know, Usher's chronology, if people were to go with that. Here's Jesus now struggling with what appears to be very much a human sort of experience, unlike Adam and Eve had. He's in a world of sin and pain, and yet where Adam and Eve fail, Jesus succeeds, where Eve questions God's word. Jesus says, God, I don't want to do it, but I will do what you want regardless of the evidence. And one, Adam and Eve would not follow God's will. Jesus follows God's will perfectly.
Yeah. And this is maybe stretching it just a little bit, but you have a tree that figures prominently in Eden. And there's a sense in which from the garden, Jesus now is going to another tree, cross.
Yeah.
So I think if we had more time, we might be able to think of even some other connections that would be beneficial. But these are helpful. Thank you. There in Gethsemane, Jesus prayed a prayer. Luke 22, verse 42, records his words, Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done. We touched on that. Those are, I think, amazing, amazing words. What does this suggest about Jesus' relationship with the Father, the words of this prayer?
That they're close, that they're tight enough that he's trusting him regardless of the fact that I don't want to do this, that I'm willing to surrender even to your will.
At a time when he's being asked to do something that's He is willingly going, and we talked last week, the week before, was Jesus happy about going to the cross? This is not a joyful experience. Mm-hmm. This is the worst experience he could go through, and yet he's willing to do so. And this is contrasted, you know, in the bigger picture with his disciples who are sleeping rather than praying. And it is one of those, Peter, who will deny him here in just a few hours. Peter will deny him because he should be in prayer seeking the Father's will, and he's not.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Peter. I'm wondering who in the Passion narrative you most identify with. This is kind of a personal question, but we could say, well, what about Peter? He loves Jesus, and yet, Brent, as you just said, he sleeps in the garden and then ultimately denies that he even knows Jesus. Mm-hmm. There's Judas, who's been with Jesus, who's seen Jesus at work, but ultimately betrays Jesus. There's Pilate, who doesn't find any fault in Jesus, but doesn't seem to want to jeopardize his position of influence. He kind of wants to keep the peace, and so he doesn't make a strong decision declaring Jesus' innocence. And then there are others in the story. Are there any, either that I've mentioned or that I haven't mentioned, that you identify with on some level?
Well, out of these three, I would have to say for me, Peter. I'm quite an extrovert and also a little random abstract, so I could see myself getting pretty bored with waiting around for this praying to end and go, I can see myself going to sleep. And then later, when someone asked me, do I know this man, if I felt like my life is at jeopardy, I think I would be the one who would say, no, I don't really know them, or try to smooth it over somehow. I don't like that, but I think he's the one I would most identify with if I were in that position and would be hoping. Either that, or would be like Pilate, just trying to make peace and kind of get by.
That's the one for me that I'm afraid that I'm too much like that. I'd be, well, you know, I know what ought to be done in this situation, but there's the bigger picture, and try to be, keep everybody.
Yeah.
We don't want there to be a big revolt, so maybe I'll kind of go along. Now, obviously, I would hope I wouldn't do that, but I sense in myself sometimes those tendencies. So, Brant, the two of us have confessed now.
Confess
how about for you?
I'm with you when you talk about Pilate, and maybe it's partly because I see myself as somewhat spineless about some things. And you know, here you have Pilate vacillating between, I have the evidence that suggests he's innocent, and yet I need to please these other people, and his own sense of conviction in who Jesus was. Could he have made a personal decision for this man Jesus when he had enough evidence to do so? And I feel like I can make that conviction when the pressure is not on. But if the pressure were on, could I?
It would be a difference.
Could I do it?
As Luke records the story, he highlights the role of some surprising people. So we already talked about Peter, who's a well-known, prominent disciple who sleeps in the garden, denies that he knows Jesus. Another disciple, Judas, betrays his master. So it was like disappointing that the disciples would do that. Then we have a thief on the cross that appeals to Jesus for salvation. You wouldn't expect that. There's a Roman centurion that says, oh, Jesus was a righteous man. Again, you wouldn't expect that. And then there's a member of the very group that condemned Jesus, the Sanhedrin, Joseph, and he provides Jesus a place of burial. And then, maybe to top it all off, it's women who care for the body of Jesus, and they're the first witnesses of his resurrection. What lessons might we learn about people and about God from these surprises in the story?
We often think of the 12 disciples as Jesus' main group, and maybe those who are most committed and most faithful to him, and yet this story highlights and contrasts their failure and their falling away with those who at the end take a stand when the pressure is on, when they could be the guilt by association. You have Joseph of Arimathea, and I think Nicodemus in the other Gospels as well, stepping forward here at the end to say it doesn't matter what the council says, we'll side with Jesus. And the women, they've been with him all along. In fact, it's women when Jesus comes into Jerusalem who are there while he's weeping. You know, he's crying for them. Mm-hmm. And now here they're the ones caring for him, and it's his mother who's at the cross, and John.
So is it fair to say, Brant, you can't judge a book by its cover sometimes?
Yeah,
very true. And that God's kingdom is inclusive of all kinds of people from all levels of socioeconomic backgrounds and gender and race and culture.
And maybe even public commitment.
Right.
Because some of these had not made the same public commitment as the disciples, and yet they were willing to be associated with, and their name tied to Jesus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's an important lesson for us that is sometimes easier to accept at a distance, to say, oh, isn't that wonderful how those cultural outsiders or outcasts or unexpected people back then were open to Jesus, it's difficult sometimes for us to acknowledge that in the here and now. Mm-hmm. Important nevertheless. So we've come right to the end of these series of lessons on the Gospel of Luke. This is our last one together. And I began with that leading question, if someone asked you for proof that Jesus is alive, how would you respond? I want to give you an opportunity to answer that
question.
Well,
I'll do a short answer, and maybe Brant can do a long answer. I don't know. I think it boils down to eyewitness for me, and that there were people who saw and worked and lived with Jesus, and they were witness to the things that happened, and they wrote them down.
And they were willing, too, if we look at history, they were willing to die for that. It wasn't just, well, this might further our cause, or maybe we'll be able to do some fundraising if people believe this. They held that belief to the point
even
of death.
Yeah,
themselves.
The end of Luke has a story that only Luke has, and that's the story of Jesus in his resurrected form appearing to two men on the road to Emmaus.
Yes.
And the beauty of the Bible study that he gave them, where he opened up the whole Old Testament and showed them all the things concerning himself. And I would have loved to have heard that Bible study. Proof? What people demand as proof is maybe a moving target. Proof, I don't know that we could provide proof, but there's evidence. There's enough evidence for hope. There's enough evidence for belief. And I think even the Old Testament gives us enough of that, that Jesus came, he lived, he died, enough to say that he's the king.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the eyewitness kind of testimony is something that can come, the personal experience is something that doesn't just come to us from the dusty pages of history. But I think it's possible for us in our lives to sense the presence of the risen Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that my hope, as imperfect and pilot-like as I might be at times, that's something that I desire for myself. And for all those listeners of ours today, I would just extend an invitation to you that as you may struggle with unbelief, some of you, I don't know, you can pray the prayer which is recorded in the Bible, Lord, help my unbelief.
Mm-hmm.
And that as you seek God's kingdom, that you too may experience the reality that Jesus is alive. Thank you, Brant and Pam, for your willingness to share. Thanks also to David Olson, our program engineer. Thank you, Jesus, for being so patient with us along life's way. And finally, to our listeners, thank you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Paul Dibdahl.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.